This is Donald Hossig with Cancer Action News Network. This program is a program, this series of our Loving the Earth Environmental Revolution series. Joining us today from Syracuse, New York, is Dr. Alan Silverstone. He is a member of the U.S. EPA's Dioxin Review Panel. Good morning, Dr. Silverstone.
Hi, Don. It's actually the science, I'm in a special science advisory board subcommittee to evaluate the dioxin reassessment document.
Okay, I understand.
And which means I'm not an employee of EPA. I am somebody who's brought in to consult because of my expertise. And I'm also not a permanent member of the science advisory board because that's yet another level with more ties. I'm strictly there for my expertise on dioxin and also my past involvement with the previous committees and processes that have been involved leading up to this last document.
Let's start with your, give the listeners a brief bio. You know, how did you come to be a person that EPA wanted to look to for guidance on the whole subject of dioxin and exposure and health effects? You know, tell us about that, and then we'll start talking about your long experience with the Dioxin Review Panel.
I started doing research on dioxin in 1988. It's a funny story. I had to get some dental work over in Rochester, which is an hour and a half drive from here, as you know. And I had known that there was a laboratory in Rochester that, in fact, had originally, under an earlier investigator, had identified the receptor for the dioxin. And it's this receptor that has the reason why dioxin has so many different kinds of effects in so many different kinds of cells and tissues and in different species. Anyway, this receptor was originally isolated in Rochester, and there was the guy there who was the main dioxin researcher, a guy named Thomas Gashevitz, has been my colleague since that time. I called him originally because I've been working on a problem about why the thymus, the gland in your neck over the heart, which makes T cells, and that is the immune cells, half of the immune lymphocyte arm that produces T cells. And I was trying to understand how certain hormones and caused the shrinkage of that organ, and because that we'd be to understand how various chemicals cause effects on the immune system. And Dr. Gashevitz had a very bright graduate student who wanted to do something with immunology and dioxin, which he hadn't been doing up till then. So we formed a collaboration in 1988, which has continued to today. Tom is now the chairman of environmental medicine at University of Rochester School of Medicine. And between us all, we produced about 27 papers together on aspects of dioxin and also on estrogen's effect on the immune system. So,
well, you certainly have the kind of background. You certainly have the kind of background that would cause, you know, anyone in the world to respect your guidance on dioxin health. So,
I came to it actually. Tom wanted to collaborate because he knew I was more of an immunologist, and actually, I went way back on that. I've worked with a couple Nobel Prize winners at MIT when I was getting my doctorate, and that I didn't have anything to do with dioxin then. But and then I did work in postdoctoral work at MIT with another Nobel Prize winner, and I produced a lot of papers for publication. People say, well, maybe I'm not one of these guys who produces 200 papers, but at least everything I've produced, I've written a substantial part of, as well as done some of the hands-on work. So, it does give me a certain status. I don't know all the aspects of dioxin, and I've learned a lot in this process of reviewing things, and we should probably talk a little bit about that so the public understands why this has been so long and protracted a process.
Yeah, that is one of the main points that I want to cover is in your long experience with the Dioxin Review Panel and this whole matter of dioxin and EPA and health and harm, disease. Give us, give us a thumbnail sketch of the dioxin review process. Just help people see. A lot of people wouldn't even know what's been going on a long time. It's been, not a front burner issue ever. Just give the public, the listener, the general person, a thumbnail sketch of, what has been taking place with EPA and dioxin during, this, your tenure with the review panel.
EPA, through its responsibilities under the Clean Air and Water Acts and so forth, and also some related agencies under CDC, which is the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registries, have prepared documents from before 1985. But this reassessment was the first document that was adopted in 1985, and I verified that recently because I'm losing track of what's happening.
So a long time.
It's 26 years ago, right?
Right.
And then the document was reworked in light of more recent scientific data, both its effects in animal studies and in trying to understand how it gets into the environment and where it goes in the environment and how it gets into people and animals and so forth. In other words, a lot more data was built up. So eventually a very big document was developed in the early 90s, and that document was reviewed by the very first Science Advisory Board on Dioxin in 1994. And that was a very strange meeting for me in a way, because that's the first time I sat in on such a review. And a number of people I knew in the field were also in the review, some people who did epidemiology and mathematical modeling and people who did the environment stuff. And it was an interesting meeting because most of it was occupied by various consulting groups consulting for industry in the main, who came and told us what we knew we didn't know about it, and therefore arguing that meant we couldn't do anything. And I think the panel generally felt is, well, we have this information so far, so we should do something, that there should be some policy adopted. And EPA had done the best it could, and this was the Science Advisory Board review in 1994, with the available scientific information, and there were things that we suggested they could do to make it better. That didn't say we should delay, but we didn't say we should delay the document or delay setting a standard. But I think there were a lot of people who were very unhappy with that conclusion. Some of those people actually were supposed to be testifying before Congress about how some of the people on the Science Advisory Board were going to testify before Congress about how the EPA had not used the best scientific standard and therefore should disqualify itself. And we asked for a vote in the board meeting about whether people agreed with our conclusion or not, the one I just mentioned, and everybody voted yes. So that hearing never happened, which I think has political overtones, to put it mildly.
Surely.
Anyway, this document was never finalized, and a lot of us involved said, well, what's going on here? And we're getting more and more information while this is going on. I mean, it isn't, neither science nor information stands still. One of the things that really happened is there were a number of population groups, particularly in Italy. There was this explosion in Seveso, Italy, which was almost a pure dioxin release into the surrounding environment. And Italy has kind of a national health service, so they were able to do a lot of studies and correlate them with the exposure levels and the amounts on a number of health effects. And that data has ultimately played into this last review, which I think suggests that, you know, dioxin is pretty dangerous at pretty low levels. But before that, this document, the first EPA document, the Science Advisory Board had made recommendations. The EPA brought people in, other consultants, to rewrite sections of the report, to expand the report. And then they went through another Science Advisory Board, one I wasn't on. And then that report went to the National Academy of Science, National Research Council, to review. And that went in from 2003 to 2006. So the National Academy is supposed to be this big impartial group that has objective evaluations and scientific questions. And they form a totally new group. And I was a little surprised that I was selected to be on that. But it was fairly balanced. There were people who believed dioxin doesn't do anything and it's all a hoax. And there were other people, and these are people with some scientific credentials, who believe it's serious, and other people who were show me what it's about. And that academy review was primarily directed at the health effects question, because what EPA was trying to establish is what is the level of dioxin in a person that we can say is associated with adverse health effects. And the reason why that becomes important is that the rest of the document from the beginning studied why does dioxin get made, how does it get made, how is it released in the environment, and how does it get into people, and each of those stages is quantitated. So if you have X amount in the soil and you have animals eating it and they get this level, then people will get this level. So establishing the level that would be of concern for health means that you therefore can go all the way back and say this is how much we have to clean up all the environments that have been contaminated with dioxin and related compounds. The second reason that number is important is that starting back in 1985, because dioxin was so toxic, people were able to relate the toxicity of other similar chemicals that are in the environment. And maybe the most common one is PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls. It is, you know, there's a ton of this stuff down in the bottom of the Hudson River. And the toxicity of PCBs could be related to the toxicity of dioxin. So if you say X amount of dioxin is bad for health, then X amount of PCBs are dangerous, and then the environment would have to be cleaned up so you get below that level of risk of health effects.
Right.
It's kind of like, you know, when they tell you that your swimming water or drinking water is contaminated, they don't really look for dangerous bacteria, but they're looking at what are called coliform counts, the number of E. coli, which is relatively benign. But if you have a certain number there that says, uh-oh, this is dangerous, what they mean is that if you have this much E. coli, you probably have X, Y, Z amount of dangerous bacteria and chemicals.
Understood.
So dioxin is kind of like that. I hope that makes some sense to
the people. I understand it very perfectly, and I'm sure you made it very clear. I'm certain many of the listeners, everyone probably can understand this. It's all very quantitative, and that's the way science has become, and it's very good that it has become quantitative, because risk is the whole matter. To me, the quantitative risk assessment, I started looking at the dioxin reassessment long after you started looking at it. I started looking at it in the, I'd say, the late 90s, and
right.
I read that Chapter 3, the quantitative risk assessment and the integrated summary of the 2003 draft dioxin reassessment. And I was very taken with how well set forth, you know, the quantification was. Let's talk about the quantification of the cancer risk. Is this something that, you know, we could talk a little bit about? You know, just basically, what was the science that people were looking at? Because it all comes down to, you know, what research papers can be applied to that certain subject area. What was the science that the experts were looking at that made it possible to start to quantify the amount of cancer risk imposed by a certain amount of dioxin exposure?
Well, there's a standard, it's interesting. I mean, almost all the ways of determining whether chemicals are dangerous or cancerous have kind of been partly developed and used in this setting this dioxin standard. So it's like covers all kinds of chemicals in the environment and also in our food and in drugs and so forth. The quantification goes like this. Dioxin, unfortunately, is scattered through our environment pretty completely.
Okay.
It's an accidental product. It's not made deliberately. But, for example, in Agent Orange in Vietnam, some of the stuff made by certain chemicals, chemical companies was almost 40% dioxin.
Wow.
And some of them were only 2 to 4%. And either way, a lot of Vietnam got polluted with stuff that had dioxin in it. And then in the U.S., there's a lot because pretty much the major herbicides and pesticides used in this country and fungicides have been made, several of them have been made using processes that accidentally generate some dioxin.
Yeah, see, this is one story. I'm certain that story has never come out. The public, the general public in the U.S., totally unaware of the fact that our country applied pesticides that meant there was dioxin contaminant being placed where the pesticide was being placed. Our country has never become aware of that was something very similar to, you know, the Agent Orange use and the dioxin contamination of Vietnam. It wasn't a tactical process. It was just done business, you know, people just using pesticides. That story has never come out to my, you know, as far as I can see, you know, very little public knowledge.
Well, it surfaces periodically when we get, you know, revisiting the problems of Vietnam vets and whether they should be compensated for various health problems. And initially there was like this denial that there was any health effect from Agent Orange, even the stuff with a lot of dioxin in it. And that's it's an interesting story itself because the initial studies were very thorough studies that were done examining about 22,000 guys who had been involved in dropping Agent Orange on Vietnam, the ranch hand study in the Air Force. And if you looked at the statistics, it didn't look like there was any excess cancer, any excess heart disease, any excess mortality. But it turned out many years later when we got much more expert at measuring the amount of dioxin in serum and in fat tissue that we could go to very low levels, that actually of those 22,000, only about 800 had substantial above background levels.
I see.
So you see that there were you had basically people who were not affected by dioxin swamping any effects that would be seen by
exactly
people with dioxin. And it's only recently that they've kind of completed a study on health effects of those people. And somebody might say, well, how do you know that's from Vietnam? Well, each of these mixtures that has dioxin in it has a very unique chemical signature in that there are other chemicals associated with it that tell you that, oh, this is what came down with Agent Orange, and this came down with the herbicide that was used on Long Island in 1995 or something like that. Mm-hmm. So we know pretty certainly in this group of people that this was a, that these among these 800 people, they had excess health problems. What wasn't studied, and Steve and Gene Stellman at Columbia University kept trying to get the Defense Department to exhume the records, the guys who were on the ground, the soldiers who were exposed to much higher levels than the ranch hand guys, because first of all, they were under and in the areas where the stuff was dropped.
Right.
And nobody told them they should take care of, you know, and protect themselves. They just, you know, used everything in the environment. And on top of that, they did a lot of local spraying of the trees to defoliate them. And I was shocked to hear the story from a couple of these guys about how, well, on a hot day, what you're doing is you have these big tanks that look like flamethrowers, except you're spraying this herbicide. And they'd spray each other to cool off.
Jeez.
So it's like
unreal.
So the Stumpins, Columbia,
wow,
try to find out what areas was a lot of this stuff used so they could go find the Vietnam vets who had actually been highly exposed.
Right.
And the military lost the records. So
yeah,
they
bet.
And so this is a typical kind of story that happens. And that stuff goes back all the way to making atomic bombs and test and the soldiers being made to stand up during the testing bombs afterwards, you know, in the Cold War. So I wasn't surprised that that was the case, that they lost the records or couldn't find
yeah.
them. And the Stellmans have done the best they could trying to find what groups of guys might have been exposed. And the vets have become more and more aware that this is one of the reasons why they have lots of health problems. You can only say, well, guys who were in a war that was very unpopular and very dangerous and all that develop a lot of problems in their heads. But no, you know, these a lot of these guys turn out to have diseases that we are finding pretty convinced now are associated with dioxin exposure. And in many of them, we can measure the levels of that. So unfortunately, their health insurance or the VA will not pay for measuring how much they have in their body. And you might say, well, you know, this has been 40 years since the war, so what does it matter? Can you even see what happened? Yes, you can, because once this stuff gets into the adult body, it takes about anywhere from 12 to 17 years for the level to drop to half. In other words, it's in your fat, and it just to get it out, you can't get it out through any normal lifestyle things, or even if you follow the latest in healthy diets. So we'd be able to tell people who are exposed, but we're kind of just kind of looking at guys. The other thing is that the Vietnam vets were a pretty good lobby for themselves in that they got the military and the VA health system agreed, more as politics, that they would accept that if somebody had diabetes and had been in Vietnam in any of the areas that this stuff was used, if they developed heart disease, if they developed hypertension, and there's a whole number of diseases, liver disease and so forth, that they'll automatically be compensated.
Well, that's good.
And that was good. That was good politics, even though the science wasn't all there yet. And I'm glad that that was agreed to, because proving this is not very easy. That's
right.
Part of the reason why this review process has been so long.
Well, Timmy, let's kind of cut to the chase on some of this.
Okay.
As far as what are the big obstacles? You know, when the review panel met several times during the course of the past, you know, 18 months or year or however long it's been that they have been meeting since the that 2003 draft was looked at by the NAS. What are the big issues that are staying in the way of the dioxin reassessment being rolled out in final draft? You know, what was proposed that led, you know, some to conclude that it wasn't ready to go?
Well, there's been people who voice argued that it's not ready to go from the beginning, and that we need more data, that some of the statistical tests aren't clear, that the models for cancer risk aren't accurate for the effect of dioxin, which is not like certain other chemicals that cause cancer. This is my personal opinion, is that some of the scientific people who object to the release or say it's not ready for prime time or it's not finalized are quite genuinely serious that they honestly believe that the level of proof of risk has to be high. There are other people on the panel, and myself included, who believe that, hey, if there's substantial evidence that there's smoke, there's probably a fire, and we don't want to keep doing it.
Sure.
And these arguments extend across all our everything today.
Everything.
Like global warming, you know.
Sure.
Do we have enough evidence? Well, there's some people who say it's not ironclad, and there's other people who say, wow, we have a lot of evidence that says otherwise, and we don't want to mess with it. You don't want to take risks. The same applies to chemicals in our food and in the environment.
Right.
You got to say, though, that this review process has made it pretty clear that you don't want to let dioxin get into the food chain, and you don't want to let things that are like dioxin or act like dioxin get into the food chain or into drugs and so forth. So, you know, it's kind of like the global warming. You know, more and more people, more and more scientists, more and more doctors accept that there's a problem here, and we should apply the precautionary principle in health rather than the certainty principle.
Right. Yeah, see, my take on these two sides, almost, so to speak, this thing of the ironclad proof and the acting with considerable proof of harm, but not, you know, the final absolute proof. And so, you know, some precaution, but not truly not even all that much precaution after a while. It's just more like acting on a substantive body of evidence of harm rather than, you know, the final details being all in place. I'm thinking that the side that's for the precaution and acting on the science is really the scientists that have no stake in holding off publication, and then the consultants that are working for Dow and Monsanto and these other companies that have cleanup problems, those seem to be the majority of the people that are saying, well, this is not proven beyond a shadow of a doubt. Is that in any way legitimate?
I'd say that's a fair characterization. I would say, though, that there are people in academia and who don't have a direct stake in the, you know, cleanup process and so forth that also argue this stand that it's, you know, without 100% proof, why do we want to go ripping up the ground and replace towns and clean up dumps again or go back to sites that have been cleaned up? I teach medical students, and medical students don't get taught a lot of epidemiology or toxicology. So I'm among the few people who sometimes, outside the curriculum, actually teach them some things about this.
Well, that's wonderful.
And the thing about people who are trained to be doctors is that, first of all, you think about all the common things. If you hear hoofbeats, think horses.
Yes.
And I'm, unfortunately, as a scientist, and I think most good scientists would say, yes, but if you hear those hoofbeats, it could be a zebra, you know, and that's part of what leads to the kind of precautionary principle. You know, if I've been on panels where people have said there's been absolutely no evidence that dioxin causes this health effect or that health effect, and I've kind of become noted for being a cranky old guy because I say something like, oh, that's really wonderful. What study was that? And, of course, you hear people flapping their lips and not being able to come up with a study that shows that there was no effect on some of these things. So in the main. And it's just the way scientists and doctors are trained to think and all that. And like you say, unless if your job depends on being subsidized by a major chemical corporation, or if you have an administration, even in a university, that tells you to shut up or else, unless you have the freedom that partly academic freedom guarantees to, you know, go where you want to go with the data and prove what you can. So but for me, it's kind of like I like to use this experience I've had because I think it illustrates a lot of problems with the regulatory system as it is and the things that we have to move through to come up with a sensible, reasonable policy, and also that we can't really wait, just as all these guys who work so hard on climate change, if, you know, keep yelling about it, you know, the how much are you willing to risk? And the case of these kind of toxic chemicals in the environment, it's like, well, how many cancers do we think is fair to happen in the environment? Most of the dioxin risk study came from how little you needed to kill an animal. People used to still go around saying dioxin is the most toxic environmental chemical we know. Well, that's true for guinea pigs because about 2 micrograms, 2.5
two millionths of a gram of per kilogram of body weight will kill a guinea pig. But if you're a hamster, you need almost 5 milligrams per kilogram to be killed. And the death incident is very interesting. I mean, it's not like the animal drops dead instantly. It actually takes about 7 days to a week to 2 weeks, and even longer for the animal to die, because what happens is it kind of starts falling apart, like people at the end of who got AIDS and it wasn't treated, or who have cancer at the last stages, where they lose all their body weight and they become emaciated looking and all that, because there are a lot of processes that are set off in their body, which is what the dioxin is doing, that essentially lead to destruction of tissue and so forth. So even though you keep feeding animals, and my colleague Dr. Gashevitz back in the 80s did a lot of studies on this, is that they the animals, it isn't the amount of food they take in, it's something happening in their bodies that is triggered by the dioxin. And,
well, getting back to the aryl hydrocarbon... Getting back to the aryl hydrocarbon receptor, and that being this very basic part of how dioxin interacts with the body and causes disease. Tell us about, is there any role for, see, your expertise being the immunology, and I've always found that a very interesting part of the how dioxin causes disease and what disease, you know, this particular constellation of diseases and harm to health it causes by interfering with the immune system. Can you tell us a little bit about how the aryl hydrocarbon receptor and immunology are interrelated?
I think that's a good jumping off point, Don, because the for a while there, they kept trying to say that the only health effect we have to worry about from dioxin is cancer. And cancer is a very scary disease, and they did some very good work that showed, yeah, that dioxin at pretty low levels can cause increase the risk of cancer.
Right.
But what we know now, in which is I was involved early on, is that much lower doses of dioxin can cause suppression of the immune system. We have some work now that shows even at very low levels you get autoimmune disease. And in these studies that have been coming out, and the newest the standard that was set this time didn't model it on cancer. It modeled on thyroid disease, especially in neonates, which is serious because if you have hyperthyroidism in utero or when you're, you know, just born, it affects your development of intelligence, you know, or your IQ, and that's very solid. And the other problem is that that was used to set the standard is if you look at adolescents who are born to women who are exposed in Seveso, even though they were born 20 years afterwards, they have lower sperm counts. So the effects associated with dioxin are very wide-ranging. So here's what the aryl hydrocarbon receptor, the protein that binds most strongly to dioxin itself, is found in every tissue in the body. It's not found in every cell type, but it's found in every tissue in the body, in humans, in mammals, in reptiles, in birds, in fish, all the way down to backboneless fish in evolution. Below that, there are proteins that kind of look like the dioxin receptor that are also involved. And these proteins that are similar to it, you there?
Yes.
I wonder what that was. Anyway,
yeah,
the... The way that dioxin receptor worked, well, it was first studied by toxicologists, and one of the main things they study is toxicology to the liver because it's a big organ and you can cut it out in mice and rats and all that. It's easy to do all kinds of things measuring it. But, for instance, when I started working on it, people were sure that the main cells in the immune system that do the main business of the immune system didn't have any receptor. And That turned out to be due to the fact that they measured it, and it from the liver is a cell that has a small nucleus with its hereditary material and a very big cytoplasm. If you look at immune cells, the functional... You still getting me?
Yep, yep.
You know what? That's going to be my phone that is low on charge. So let me get another phone here that be the same line.
Sounds
I just
good.
Don't want us to just drop off the edge of the earth here.
Yeah, be good.
Anyway, the people.
Yeah, just jump on another phone. That'd be cool.
Yeah.
Kind of hard to do it. You get the connection though.
Yeah. Is that work? Are we still here?
Yeah, yeah, perfect. Good
okay,
work.
Good. This phone has a full charge.
Okay. Awesome.
I didn't realize it was the low charge then. The this receptor looks like a lot of these other proteins that are found in all these tissues in the body, in animal species and all that, that control all kinds of circadian rhythms and other development, that there's kind of control switches in development. And now, after me being in this so long, the what we think is this protein, when it's activated, has something to do with either suppressing the immune response, which you normally want to do or if you don't want to get autoimmune disease, or or activating the immune response. And you might say it's very interesting now because people have developed drugs that are involved in suppressing things like allergy and asthma that actually work through this particular protein. And other people, colleagues of mine actually, are looking at things that will activate the receptor to activate the immune system. So we know it's important in the immune system. We know it's important in the liver. We know if mice don't have it, their vasculature and development doesn't work. We were one of the two groups that discovered if you don't have this protein, you develop cardiomyopathy. That means, you know, the heart gets huge and doesn't really pump sufficiently. So we know that this receptor has a lot to do with all kinds of aspects of development. And if it's activated, since it's there, it probably normally is activated. But like things that normally work in the body, you want them to kind of turn on and off real quick or to just be on for a short time.
Right.
And dioxin is like a signal that keeps it turned on until the cells finally die.
Oh, wow.
Or the cells multiply so many times that you dilute it out to a level that it can't really work. So that's really why I think most of my collegial friends who work in this believe that that's kind of what happens, that you have the switch that's turned on and can't be turned off if dioxin is doing the turning on.
Okay.
And so here you have, so this is this important protein, affects all kinds of processes and controls them, and here you have a chemical that's an accident of production and all that, or related chemicals, some of which are deliberate, like PCBs, that will keep it turned on because they don't get destroyed in the environment. They're very persistent. They hide out in fat, and they can build up to pretty high levels in fat, and then they're hard to get rid of. That's kind of why it's going to be a problem with us for a long time. I remember in the early review stages, they talked about, you know, where's all the dioxin hiding out, and there's a huge reservoir of this stuff in the center of Lake Michigan.
Right.
It's the number was so staggering. I kind of went out and had a beer because I couldn't think of, what the heck are they going to do about that?
Right.
So,
look at this. As far as, say, the other POPs, you know, like there's the PCBs, and I'm well aware that there are dioxin-like PCBs. But, see, I don't know this. I don't know this right here. Say would something like, say another POPs that is an endocrine disruptor, such as, say, chlordane or Myrex or toxaphene or the brominated flame retardants, these chemicals that they're not considered to be, say, dioxin-like, but they are endocrine disruptors just as dioxin is an endocrine disruptor. Will these chemicals have any role in affecting that that receptor that we've been talking about?
Well, some of them do. That's why we
you know, those that are dioxin-like affect the receptor, and some of them actually are very different. But these mixtures of these chemicals, which is, and they're only produced as mixtures like PCBs, they take biphenyls, something that's just carbon and hydrogen, and they pump in chlorine under pressure and heat, and then you get a mixture of 209 different chemical conformations.
Okay.
And some of those chemicals can bind the thyroid hormone receptor. I mean, the list has gotten longer and longer and longer. They, when we started working on dioxin in the immune system, there were people who insisted that the effect was dioxin was acting like an estrogen in the immune system. And, yeah, estrogen does affect the immune system, but the effect of dioxin, and we had to essentially prove it in order to get our grant money the first time, was to show that it was a totally different pathway. You know, in other words, you
okay.
can have different receptors being affected
right.
that will add up. When we calculate risk, we don't, that's not done. You know, you just, they're focused strictly on what is dioxin going to do. And, of course, that's nice for a laboratory study, but in the human environment, we're exposed to huge numbers of different chemicals, some of which will amplify the effects or add to the effects and so forth. So, again, I think the precautionary principle is the right way to proceed with this, you know, how we handle this and regulate it.
Yeah, and it just seems to me all the more so when you consider the fact that people are not only being exposed to dioxins, but all these other puffs. Like these PCBs and the brominated flame retardants and the old pesticides, the DDT, the Myrix, the toxaphene.
Right.
When you consider that, in addition to the knowledge about the dioxins, it just seems like it will be so reasonable if they can't do something, say, specific on dioxin, they should at least do something specific on this whole collection of chemicals that do impose similar disease risk. You know, because what I'm hearing from the WHO is that you've been talking about the dioxin, the presumptive diseases for Vietnam vets for dioxin exposure, and them being cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes and cancer. Well, that's the same thing it is with all the POPs, you know, that people get exposed to in so much more quantity in addition to the dioxins. You know, just it seems crazy to me that government hasn't jumped on this a long time ago and warned the public to avoid exposure to the extent of minimizing their exposure to POPs. You know, if they can't do it for dioxin because of Dow and Monsanto arguing about cleanup standards, it seems like the government should at least go there for collective POPs, you know, because it's so much more of a risk.
You there?
Yep.
Sorry, I was worried I was losing your signal. You know, I'm sympathetic, but, you know, I mean, already this standard that the Science Advisory Board supported that was developed. The EPA rewrote their document and did a much more precise calculation and also updated the literature. I mean, it was pretty good review. They had a meeting after the people at Argonne Labs who were contracted. They dug up every paper they could find on the effects of dioxin and POPs. And then, you know, we had to review them in different subject areas and decide which of these suggested a standard.
Okay.
The fact that this standard, the numbers that are derived here, are causing a great deal of upsetness because they suggest that even areas that have already been remediated might have to be remediated again to get them down to the level that's, you know, in accord with what we're saying.
So tell me, what's the difference? You know, what was the soil cleanup standard back before this science was put in, you know, looked at, and what's the recommended standard now?
Well, you're catching me there, and I don't.
That's
want to
okay. I think it was like
thing.
What it was. It was like 1 in 1,000 something. You know, I don't remember what it was, picograms per gram or something like this.
Yeah,
but
it was
a huge.
You know,
what's the difference in the numbers, Joel? It's pretty big, right?
They were looking at pretty low levels, you know, but I think that this report suggests that even though that was a low level and there was a lot of upsetness about having to clean up those things that to that level, that this is going to cut the level by fivefold to tenfold
yeah.
below.
Yeah.
So I will imagine the politics will get played out in the end about, okay, you say this is dangerous, but we aren't going to do anything because we're in an economic recession and we need government money for something else and so on and so on. You know, I think we should hire a lot of people to clean things up, but that's a personal opinion.
I totally agree with you. There's got to be a huge amount of cleanup considering. See, it all seems so simple when you just kind of step back from it. And see, I have it's an opportunity that, say, some others don't have. In not being meticulously involved in creating the solid scientific data that you are doing, then, see, I don't have to invest my energies in thinking into that, then I can just step back and kind of look at the big picture of all this different stuff together, you know, once it's been published, and not have to do that hard work of producing it, but just to do the hard work of thinking about using it. And it just seems so clear that now that all this science has been published, that it all points in direction of harm at levels of exposure, whether it's in the levels in soil or the levels in the food supply, all this harm from all these chemicals over all this long period of time, and then you see all this disease out there, this very diseases that are associated with exposure to POPs and dioxins. It just seems you'll be so wise to warn the public about minimizing their exposure, which it's so much this matter of minimizing intake of animal fat. We've published a health hazard advisory. We've published a health hazard advisory. We started putting it up in public places, and we're very hopeful that the government will get into it because, you know, we're not big enough to do this worldwide or even, like, countywide. We just want some help from the government. It's the way we see this coming down.
Well, I think that's, you know, there's very powerful economic interests that don't want to spend the money on it or make the taxpayers spend the money. You know,
and they don't want to lose the animal fat sales either.
Right. I mean, it's, you know, the cattle. I have to admit it, I'm a steak eater, but, you know, I'd minimize my intake of stuff. And at least what's happened is that if they find high levels of dioxin or dioxin-like compounds in food, for instance, in Belgium, they had a real screw-up in that they were using fat from an cooking oil from things like McDonald's and all that.
Yep.
But somehow somebody contaminated that with industrial oils that happen to have a lot of dioxin in it.
Wow.
So what happened is all the milk from these cows in Belgium, which goes to make Belgium chocolate, which of course is you know one of the best. They had to basically, stop shipping out the chocolate and get rid of it because the levels that ended up in the chocolate were unsafe even by the earlier standard. If you started so if people were eating Belgian chocolates that were made in this particular period of time, they would get a high level of dioxin in their body because it's a good vehicle to deliver that. And then, we don't know what would happen. I mean, they wouldn't, even if they ate several boxes of chocolate, they aren't going to look like that Russian, the Ukrainian guy who got poisoned deliberately.
Right.
But, you know, it's the long-term effects.
Right.
And, I mean, the thing that we've done recently on PCBs and dioxin, which I believe has passed all the peer reviews it has to, is that people who are not obese under the age of 55 have a much higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes if they have a certain level of PCBs or above in their body.
Hmm.
So I mean, for instance, there's not a lot of money to do field epidemiology, toxicology. We studied it in Anniston, Alabama, which is where maybe almost half the PCBs were made in the U.S.
Wow.
And that's a very sad story. I mean, this is it was a community of black and white sharecroppers that grew up after the Civil War, and they put this chemical plant that made PCBs in a floodplain right in the middle of all the sharecroppers. So you had people eat this stuff since 1929, and probably you're the highest exposed community in the world till they stopped making it. The other thing is that industry saying, well, we're doing enough to clean it up. The levels are falling in people. We don't have to do any extra cleanup. And, right, I mean, it looks like the levels have come down from what they were years ago, but they've kind of reached a point where, as the review panel in the Academy said, it looks like, you know, we're reaching a point where it's an equilibrium, so we have to find out that we have to clean up more than we've been cleaning up. Otherwise,
and it appears that the levels, even though they've come down, they're still too high. You know, it's not like they're safe levels that we've come down to. It's another,
right.
Another big
part and also, it's kind of like it came down, but now it's kind of not coming down as fast as it was.
Right. Right.
So that's, I don't know. You know, I mean, remember these things were kind of miracle chemicals. I mean, PCBs were used in batteries and capacitors. The stuff's indestructible. It's cheap to make. You can get tons of it. GE based its fortune on it, you know, and the stuff they didn't use or was overused or not used properly wound up in the bottom of the Hudson. And, you know, so you think GE is going to pay for all the economic consequences and health consequences that came from there? No way. They couldn't afford it.
It's not possible. It's truly, and like you're saying, you said something that I'd like to, you know, pull back to a little, and maybe we'll just have to do another whole interview to kind of like cover that aspect of it. And
sure.
In fact, let's do that. Let's do a whole second interview in this you know, this subject area here, where you share with us what you've learned that should be changed to get a better result, you know, the next time something comes along like this, because it certainly will. You know, there's no end to the, you know, the problems that can come along when there's big corporations doing this and that and small people out there just trying to survive and the government not really doing its job and all these various things. Do really want to believe that there's some learning going on, and you certainly, I'm sure, can provide some great guidance on what could be fixed about the regulatory process and the review process and the use of science, you know, just getting very, very basic in this, how to get a better result the next time something like this, you know, comes along.
Well, I'd love to do that, Don. And I got to say, just even working this one through has, you know, brought together things in my head that I'd kind of been thinking about for a long time. It's a big problem, and I think the public gets bamboozled a lot because, remember, if a major corporation with its PR department or consultants that they hire, they can hire people who are, in my view, I kind of regard it as like throwing sand in your eyes, you know. I got into this. I mean, to be honest, people should know that. I do have a bias in this way. I started working on the issue of workplace chemical safety and health, and I was involved in the beginning of the COSH movement. That's the Committees for Occupational Safety and Health. Back in the late 60s, and they started in Boston and New York, and from that I got an idea of just, you know, we thought that, okay, it's the guys who make these chemicals are going to be exposed at the worst, and then we gradually found out that, oh, no, you know, the public gets it, because sometimes we get all these safety programs in for the workers, and they know it's bad stuff, but the public doesn't, so, so I have a bias. I have a bias that chemicals aren't all wonderful and that there can be a dark side and we have to do it. On the other hand, you know, I have a kind of semi-public talk now for medical students or graduate students about these particular issues. And I kind of like to start off with that Clint Eastwood picture for the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Really? That sounds cool.
And what it is we by finding this receptor, we're actually starting to develop a set of drugs that will be very helpful for people's health. On the other hand, we are trying to understand, you know, why these chemicals don't do the bad stuff, and dioxin and POPs do the bad stuff. And in a simple sense, I'm sure that's because the POPs are not metabolized. They aren't broken down rapidly.
Yep.
And these other chemicals that we're making are things that are going to that do break down and rapidly. So, you know, this it's it's interesting. I'm not, you know, I'm not one of those people who says all chemicals are bad and evil, or we shouldn't try to make chemicals. I think that what we have to do is do a lot of thinking about what we're doing, and certainly about getting rid of things. I mean, I think one of the very positive things in this country is the recycling movement and so forth. You know, that I don't know if I have friends who go over to China now, you know, and they are doing what we did back in the 20s and 30s with the early industrialization, and there's these whole cities and valleys that are just polluted unbelievably. And, you know, it's like a moonscape in some cases. And I think that when people, you know, when I lose my temper at all these candidates who are talking about you got to get rid of the EPA.
They're crazy.
You know, the EPA has failings. It makes mistakes. You know, it's like any government agency. And
yes.
Also, it has to respond to politics. And it won't do the right thing unless there's kind of lots of people out there saying this is the right thing. So I get pretty angry at saying get rid of it, because we have had lots of discussions about, you know, if we didn't have it, we kind of start looking like we would have looked like the Chinese or Eastern Europe 30 years ago. So
we've got to have the EPA. Truth of it is, we need more EPA rather than less EPA.
Exactly. And and I think that's true through all the regulatory agencies. As an outsider, you know, I look at it and I say, well, why can't they do it this way, you know, like the other agencies doing? It's a government thing, right? And they said, no, that agency has this rule and this agency has this rule, and I can't do this and I can't do that. It's like EPA can do the outside, but the Occupational Safety and Health Administration does the inside, and they have different standards. And so it's like, you know, excuse me. But, yeah, I think I'd like to talk about that. And I think the way you posed these questions were pretty good. They helped me focus. So,
well, you've done a fantastic job. I'm looking forward to part two here. Yeah,
okay.
Let's just wrap this up. You're busy, I'm busy. So give me what would you say as an individual? This is not as a member of the. This is not speaking for the Science Advisors Board, Dax Review panel. This is
or
an individual scientist.
Right.
Yeah, and not speaking for the university, but just as an individual, very sharp scientist. That's very well read and very understanding of this particular subject area. What would your recommendation be to do about dioxin?
I think basically, I don't know totally. I this document, the standard, is really sitting on the EPA administrator's desk. And the question is, will it be said, this is the law now, and we have all these, well, you know, if Obama doesn't get elected and he doesn't report and Lisa Jackson doesn't stay in the business, that may get deferred again for political reasons. But it should be approved. And the major conclusion from it has to be that we got to find out all the ways that dioxin gets accidentally made and put in the environment. And same for the POPs. And reduce those, reduce the stuff going into the environment, find the places that have been contaminated. I mean, there's like weird things that people, some of the stuff containing a lot of dioxins and POPs in, say, the South were pumped into these wells, and then clay from these wells was taken to add to chicken feed, for example, and then you have eggs that have so much dioxin in it, you can't use it, right? So it's like there should be a lot of surveillance. There's not a lot of money for it. You have people like Arnold Schechter and pretty much a lot of the people who did the environmental stuff, then they beg, borrow research grants, and they send out small groups of people who sample the environment, and they come back and they measure the amount of it. There should be kind of a real serious national survey of, you know, where are all the hot spots, where is stuff done, and let's just get rid of it. I watched them cleaning up in Anniston, which you got to realize, I mean, they stopped making it in 1973, and it's apparent that Monsanto knew that there were health consequences of this particular pollution, but it's sure taken them till 2000 to start cleaning it up. And it required a lot of the lawsuits, and I have mixed feelings about those. They socked it to the company in the lawsuits, but then the money that's awarded is the lawyers go off and say, well, you guys decide what you want to do with the money, and you have people who are poor and don't know what to do, and you see things that are just god-awful that way. I mean, they had a big settlement in Anniston, and people didn't know they were supposed to pay taxes on some of the money they got. And then the IRS immediately came in to straighten them out. So, it's not funny. I mean, it's like I was impressed by the people who pursued the lawsuit, but then when you see that they didn't carry it out all the way and they should have set up a substantial fund to monitor and deal with future health effects. I mean, Anniston has some of the worst mortality in the United States. The county Anniston is in actually has the worst mortality in Alabama, which has some of the worst mortality in the U.S. Higher cancer rates, higher heart disease rates, higher, you know, all those lovely things that people die of. And it's I believe it's, you know, largely due to the fact that they loaded their ground with these pops. And,
Those people certainly were born to suffer, being born in that place.
Well, we don't even know all the health effects. I mean, we have some good studies that shows that there's serious IQ effects from where people whose parents were exposed at high levels, even though their levels are getting down toward the U.S. normal average. And I think that's bad enough anyway. If you consider that maybe 20% of the kids in this population are really going to be at serious intellectual deficits for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, just one adverse health effect is truly a terrible burden, let alone the whole constellation of adverse health effects.
Right.
Yeah, it's certainly this is probably one of the biggest public health matters that's ever come along for the human race, and it's certainly good to know that there's people like you working on it, and like David Carpenter and, like you say, Dr. Schechter. This is, you know, people are rising up to do the good work that they must do to, you know, just get something right here. It's good It's good to talk to you, Dr. Silverstone. You're a great guest.
It's good talking to you, Don, and I really think you're doing the right thing trying to make sure the New York Cancer prevention program includes some real perspective on the chemicals in the environment and contaminated areas. I think that's really important that go on.
Well, it's your research and the research of the others that is the basis for arguing that. You guys have made it easy for the activists, having all this good science to use. And, certainly the New York State Department of Health must start using science to protect public health, and they are far from doing that right now as far as when you talk about chemicals. Way off the page.
Somewhere maybe when we talk again, we talk about the Onondaga Lake cleanup. I sit on.
Oh yeah, there you go. That'd be a good subject.
Yeah,
I think we have an endless number of shows we could do. You know.
Right. Yeah. Except I can't do that. Why don't you think about dates?
Okay.
I just took a vacation and.
Let me wrap up the show and then we can talk a little bit. Hopefully you'll have a great weekend because you started off my weekend real good here.
Okay, thanks.
This has been Donald Hussig and Dr. Alan Silverstone. We have been giving you another in the series Loving the Earth, Environmental Revolution. Have a great day.
Thanks, Don. Thanks for having me.